family.
So that's
Ruth Ramirez speaking in one of the videos that you produced. Could you say very quickly, Debbie Nathan, what happened?
She ended up in a deportation center not far from the reporter who you just interviewed, and she ultimately went back to Mexico, and she has three U.S. citizen, U.S.-born children who accompanied her, and a DACA-age child who was just applying for DACA. They're all back in Mexico now.
We're going to leave it there, but congratulations on your very important work, and we'll continue to follow it. Debbie Nathan, investigative reporter for the ACLU of Texas. We'll link to her report in The Intercept, headlined, "They're Taking Everybody." Videos show Texas troopers ripping apart immigrant families during traffic stops. And this breaking news, South African anti-apartheid activist, former head of Greenpeace International, Kumi Naidoo, has been named the next Secretary General of Amnesty International. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. The time is 4:59, and up next is the evening news.
Means access to music, news, and programming for everyone. That's why I support KBOO with my contribution every year. It's also why I match that gift to the Oregon Cultural Trust. When you make a gift to KBOO, make a matching gift to the Cultural Trust by December 31st. Then you can use the cultural tax credit next year to reduce your state tax bill. It's true. And it's also how KBOO supporters guarantee access to cultural programming in Portland and all around the state. Visit culturaltrust.org today to learn more before December 31st.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News... The trial for Jeremy Christensen has been set.
The U.S. opioid epidemic is affecting U.S. life expectancy.
And the UN General Assembly has defied the U.S.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 21st, 2017. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. The trial of aggravated murder suspect Jeremy Christian has been set for June 2019, over 2 years after police say Christian fatally stabbed two passengers, 23-year-old Taliesin Namkai Mechi and 53-year-old Ricky Best, and seriously injured a third passenger, Micah Fletcher, 23, on a Portland MAX train in the Hollywood District. The trial is presumed to last upwards of 5 weeks, including a jury time may require to determine Christian's penalty if it finds him guilty. If convicted of aggravated murder, Christian could be sentenced to life in prison with a possibility of release after 30 years, life in prison with no release, or death row. The prosecution has made no decision about which penalty it will seek if Christian is found guilty. Defense attorneys have hinted at possible mental health defenses. Multnomah County Circuit Judge Cheryl Albrecht set the trial dates during a hearing last Friday. Prosecutors said they could be prepared for a trial as early as October 2018, but Christian's attorneys asked for the later court date.
Police accountability in Portland doesn't involve much public authority. The exception to that rule is the Citizen Review Committee. Earlier this month, they heard a case that exposed what one officer has described as a common police practice of lying to the public. Jasmine Moneymaker has more.
A recent investigation by the Independent Police Review, which led to findings by the Portland Police Bureau and an appeal hearing before the Citizen Review Committee, has exposed what one officer described as a common PPB practice of lying to protesters in order to stop them from filming the police. Now, Chief Daniel Outlaw will have to weigh in on the issue. On November 30th, 2016, days after the Army Corps of Engineers announced a December 5th deadline for water protectors to withdraw from their camp at Standing Rock, Portland activists held a demonstration in the Northwest Industrial District near a terminal owned by pipeline-connected company Phillips 66. The demonstration was peaceful, and picketers stayed on the sidewalk for the most part. Nevertheless, the police presence was strong. KPTV estimated at the time that there were, quote, as many or more officers present as protesters. The Portland Police Bureau Incident Action Plan for the day listed their first objective as facilitating the public's ability to exercise their free speech rights. However, a sergeant supervising the traffic unit was attempting to do just the opposite when he approached Benjamin Carenza, who was standing on the sidewalk, and told him that he was illegally filming the police, going so far as to say that he could be arrested if he didn't stop. Sergeant Aaron Smith freely admitted to IPR investigators on multiple occasions that he had lied to Carenza about the legality of filming, saying that it was a common tactic used by police to affect the behavior of the public, and that they did it, quote, all the time. He even suggested that they especially targeted inexperienced protesters who were likely to fall for the tactic. Despite this stunning admission, Captain Mike Krebs, who reviewed IPR's investigation and found the allegation that Smith had lied to Carenza to be supported by the evidence, insisted that this was not a common practice. This is an exchange between Mike Krebs and CRC member Candace Avalos.
So I think this is a one-off. I mean, that's what I believe. This is not what we're trained. We weren't trained to lie in circumstances like this. Our policy says we're not supposed to lie in circumstances like this. So I believe it's a one-off. I think that this is the first time I've heard of this before in a situation like this. So that's what I think this is. That's what I think this is. You should have done.
Even if you think it's a one-off, I guess I would say a lot of people disagree with that, and I would hope that your opinion of it being a one-off would not stop you from saying we need to have a discussion about this and make sure retrain or do whatever it is you need to do to make sure everyone is on the same page now, even if they weren't before, then you can't do that. So that's my recommendation, I guess.
I think that's what we should probably make to the chief and recommendation going over to the chief of police. One of the things...
Filming the police is protected First Amendment activity in Oregon and in the U.S. As Matt Dos Santos, legal director for the ACLU of Oregon, pointed out, officers lying to the public about their rights should be taken seriously.
The right to report is protected by state and federal constitutions. It's been found repeatedly that prohibiting members of the public from reporting on duty officers in public is a violation of people's First Amendment rights. Bystander videos are a powerful tool for police accountability. In 2015, the Oregon legislature was so concerned about protecting the right to record that they passed a law, HB 2704, to clarify that civilians can openly record police without permission and without warning the police that they are recording. By passing this law, the legislature made clear that they wanted to send a message to law enforcement about the need to protect this right. The ACLU recently settled a case, Medina versus City of Portland, against the Portland Police Bureau, Gresham Police, and TriMet about this very issue. That settlement required officer training on a civilian's right to film. The settlement noted that this training is essential to effectuate Portland Police Bureau's directives and policies regarding the First Amendment right to film, and essential to ensuring that the right to record would be respected. It's very concerning to us that after PBD trained its officers on this issue, a sergeant still believes it's appropriate to lie to a member of the public about the law as a, quote, tactic to try and get the member of the public to stop filming. PBD officers should not be trying to dissuade or discourage members of the public from exercising their right to record. This kind of tactic undermines the spirit of the settlement agreement and could subject Portland Police Bureau to further litigation from the ACLU. It's also an affront to police accountability. Yes, the IPR got it right that the officer improperly communicated that reporting to police is a crime, but their second finding that the officer did not threaten arrest, and I think this is internal affairs, the second finding that the officer didn't threaten arrest is disappointing and deeply concerning. In keeping with the constitutional and state law protections, police should not be permitted to tell people that they could be arrested for recording. telling someone they are subject to arrest for recording is far more severe than telling someone not to report in the first place. And the IPR's findings and internal affairs findings should reflect that fact. In making his findings, the internal affairs, I think it's Captain Krebs, right, failed to adequately protect Helen's right to record. It appears from the characterization of Sergeant A's admission that the deciding factor was that Sergeant A only spoke about his authority to arrest Appellant for filming, which fell short of saying he was going to use his authority to arrest. Neither the courts nor common sense tell us that's how threats operate. Threats do not need to be accompanied by an explicit statement of intent to warn the recipient of potential harmful consequences. For example, if a person walks into a store with a gun pointed at the cashier and says to the cashier, "The gun is loaded, hand me your money," we can easily conclude that the cashier is operating under the threat of being shot. That is true even though the person with the gun never expressly said, "I'm going to shoot you," or "I will shoot you." Threats can be and often are implied. Sergeant A admits to telling Appellant that he could arrest him for filming. Any reasonable person would interpret that statement coming from an on-duty police officer as a threat of arrest. The finding that a threat must be articulated with particular words does not make sense, nor is it supported in case law. I'm almost done. The sergeant also admits that he's employing his tactic to make Appellant stop filming should further bolster the finding of an improper threat. If officers are allowed to simply wordsmith their threats to avoid internal accountability, then officers will be permitted to suppress First Amendment rights with impunity. The Bureau will lose ability to effectuate their policies and practices, and the Bureau will lose public trust. For these reasons, it's important that the CRC sustain Appellant's second allegation.
Thank you.
As troubling as it is that PPB officers are lying to the members of the public, that wasn't the appeal that the Citizen Review Committee was there to hear. They were there for a second charge that related to the incident, one that had been ruled not sustained by the Bureau, indicating that there wasn't enough evidence to support the allegation. The second charge was that Sergeant Smith had threatened to arrest Carenza if he didn't stop filming. While no one disputed that Smith had told Carenza he, quote, he could be arrested, Captain Krebs didn't find could to be a threat. To their credit, the CRC was having none of it, and their reasoning highlights the importance of having community involvement in the police oversight chain, namely that members of the Portland Police Bureau and members of the Portland public don't view the police in the same way. And what for an officer may come down to semantics, for a person on the street has the potential to be very threatening indeed. Here's CRC member Julie Falk talking about what constitutes a threat in her mind.
If I had knowledge that a police officer was lying to me, that feels threatening on its face to me. And so anything that comes after that is going to have a different level of threat to me because I know he's lying. And that's very intimidating.
And this is CRC member Daniel Schwartz.
The officer question also in his interview says the words that he lied. He says, this is a quote, "I lied to Appellant about whether he was going to be arrested or not." Those are words that the officer said in his statement that he said to Appellant. That sounds like it goes even past could. That's would.
This is CRC Chair Kristen Malone.
Yeah, I'm also inclined to challenge. I don't think that this is a particularly he said situation. I think, I appreciate that the Bureau has kind of agreed that this entire situation is really not what we want to be doing. I think not only just lying to a citizen, but lying about constitutional rights, rights of the Ninth Circuit is recognized, rights of the state of Oregon is recognized, just to see if you can get away with a lie, just to see if you can keep somebody from exercising their rights is really, really abhorrent. And you do it in a situation where somebody knows their rights, and that's extremely terrible. And let's say you do it in a situation with somebody who doesn't know their rights, maybe it's not First Amendment, maybe it's a Fourth Amendment thing. Maybe it's a, I can come into your apartment, you better let me in, or I'm going to pull you over. I mean, it's just not something that we want to be doing. It's really scary, and I appreciate that the Bureau has recognized that. But, you know, in thinking about our standard of review and thinking about this issue of threats, this is a situation where the officer was interviewed on three separate occasions, and every time he admitted to threatening the appellant. You know, here on the last one, okay, at any point through any conversation with the appellant, did you threaten to arrest him for filming you? Answer, that was at the first. Okay. And then when I told him that he could be arrested, but that was it. I mean, it's just, it seems so clear that, you know, I think that maybe there is a situation where the word could be used, and it really is about let me inform you. You know, I pulled you over, and I'm not giving you a ticket. You should know that you could be ticketed for speeding. You know, that's a could that is not a threat, but I think in the circumstances here and based on what the officer says he intended to do with those statements, I think, obviously, to me, it was a threat. And I say obviously because that's where I get to a reasonable person place.
The CRC voted unanimously to challenge the Bureau's findings for the second allegation, meaning that the matter will now go to the Chief of Police, who can either agree or disagree with the challenge. If she disagrees, the matter will go before the City Council.
Okay, so, this will be taken to the Chief of Police. She will review the challenge and either agree or disagree. If she disagrees, we will come back for a conference hearing. We will receive notice of that hearing. The purpose of that hearing will be to see if she and we can come to some sort of agreement. If at the end of that we continue to disagree, the appeal will go to City Council for the ultimate decision.
KBOO News contacted the Portland Police Bureau for comment on this issue, but the Acting Public Information Officer, Sergeant Pete Simpson, declined to comment on an ongoing investigation. He did, however, find it within his heart to give out Benjamin Carenza's full name, which we knew but hadn't mentioned, and which is not part of the public record for this case.
All remaining
Jasmine Moneymaker for KBOO News.
All remaining evacuation orders for areas around the smoldering remnants of Southern California's massive wildfire were canceled Thursday after a new round of winds caused minimal fire activity. The lifting of the evacuation orders and warnings in Santa Barbara County has left only the small, remote Rose Valley inside the wilderness of neighboring Ventura County under an order banning residents and visitors. According to Information Officer Brandon Vaccaro, other parts of Southern California are still under high-risk warning due to the Santa Ana winds, low humidity, and very, very dry vegetation. The only visible flame on the northern side of the large fire has been from controlled burns set by firefighters in order to clear combustible material in the wilderness. About 18,000 homes and other buildings are still threatened. Even when there is no sign of flame, fires can rekindle. The Thomas Fire, which began December 4th, is responsible for two deaths and has burned about 425 square miles, consuming 750 homes. The blaze was 60% contained as of press time and is the second largest in California's history.
More Americans are battling opioid addiction than ever before, and the deaths of those who lose the fight are driving down the nation's life expectancy rates. That's according to a pair of reports released today by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. The reports titled Mortality in the United States 2016 and Drug Overdose Deaths in the United States 1999 to 2016 have several key findings which are troubling health experts. Not only was the average American life 1 month shorter in 2016 than it was in 2015, but the young are dying younger while the older Americans live increasingly longer lives. According to CDC data, 63,000 people died of drug overdoses in the U.S. in 2016. The majority were between the ages of 25 and 54. Nearly two-thirds of those deaths involved overdoses of synthetic opioids like fentanyl, which doubled from 2015 to 2016. Robert Anderson, chief of the mortality branch at the National Center for Health Statistics, was quoted by NPR saying, quote, "I'm not prone to dramatic statements, but I think we should be really alarmed. The drug overdose problem is a public health problem, and it needs to be addressed. We need to get a handle on that," end quote. The states hardest hit were West Virginia, Ohio, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania, with the District of Columbia close behind. Opioid-related deaths in Oregon were below the national average in 2016, representing a continuing trend of decline from 2011 peak when 332 people died across the state.
Public News Service is a member-supported news organization that aims to report on our nation's top stories and serve underrepresented groups from across the United States. Here's today's roundup.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, December the 21st, 2017. I'm Mike Clifford. In focus on our nationwide rundown, educators panning the GOP tax plan, calling it a bad deal for working families. Inaction by Congress could leave nearly 2 million kids without health care. And we'll introduce you to the lead elf who connects struggling families with Christmas trees. Topping our news, President Donald Trump made good Wednesday on his promise to deliver what he called a big, beautiful tax cut before Christmas. The New York Times reports Trump will soon affix his signature to the $1.5 trillion tax overhaul that will have broad and far-reaching implications for individual and corporate finances. The Times says it's not clear whether Trump is going to sign the bill before the end of the year. The GOP still needs to work with Democrats to avert automatic spending cuts that would be set off as a result of the tax bill adding to the deficit. Meantime, education experts are speaking out against the GOP tax plan, saying it could lead to less money for schools and hurt working-class families.
The bill permanently slashes corporate taxes from 35 to 21% and is projected by the Joint Committee on Taxation to drive up the deficit by $1.5 trillion. A modest tax cut for middle-class families will end in 2027. Jane Hartley, a teacher from Costa Mesa, predicts her students' families will lose out.
It makes me livid that the tax cuts for the corporations will still be in place in 10 years, and yet most families' taxes will have gone back up. Meanwhile, we're saddling our children with even more debt.
Republican leaders argue that the tax cuts will juice the economy, creating more jobs and prosperity. Opponents note that it could hurt consumers by driving up insurance premiums once healthy young people are no longer required to buy coverage. Hartley argues it will draw students away from public schools by allowing families to save money for private schools tax-free. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Lawmakers did back off on two items important to the education community. Graduate students' loan money will not be taxed, and teachers still will be able to claim a $200 deduction for school supplies they buy for their classrooms. Meantime, Lori Stern reports hundreds of marchers will take to the streets in Minneapolis this evening to remember people who died from lack of housing.
It's the 33rd annual Homeless Memorial March. Kirsten Rookie with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless says more than 9,000 Minnesotans a night do not have a place to sleep. In 2017, 169 of them died.
There's not enough beds for every single person that needs shelter that night. And on any given night, actually, children make up one-third of the amount that are experiencing homelessness.
The march is to raise awareness of the problem and to remember those who died. Each victim's name will be read out loud, and marchers will carry a candle for each of them.
And Mary Sherman has an update for us now on a budget story we've been following. It's down to the wire for Congress to pass a bill to provide long-term funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program. A new report shows if lawmakers don't act soon, nearly 2 million kids could lose coverage in January.
CHIP funding expired in September, and lawmakers recently approved a patch that reallocates funds from states that have not exhausted their own CHIP funds. But Georgetown University's Center for Children and Families Executive Director Joan Alker says it's robbing Peter to pay Paul.
We know that Congress is anxious to leave town, but they must act on a long-term CHIP extension before they go, or children will start to lose coverage in January. Families need the peace of mind as they head into this holiday season that their children's CHIP coverage will be secure.
The patch reallocated the nearly $3 billion in redistribution funds among states, giving more money to 20 states with immediate shortfalls. Alker says with no new money added, 31 states will run out of money more quickly than previously estimated.
And with funding cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency and auctions of public lands, the situation seems dire for those invested in protecting the country's natural resources. But Stephanie Carson reports some organizations are finding ways to work in the current political climate.
Resource Institute is a nonprofit that pairs available federal funds with water conservation projects around the country. Board Chair Squeak Smith says their work is continuing with current projects in western North Carolina.
I don't think it's the end of the world. We still have avenues to be able to work with existing programs. Funding that we have received goes on for the next several years. So it's not like, oh, boom, we're stopping everything.
Past projects by Resource Institute include parts of Dotson Branch, Stone Mountain State Park, Fisher River, and Ring Creek. The organization also helps public and private entities with the design of projects and permit applications.
And finally, Eric Gladys reports struggling families could get a break on Christmas trees, which can run $100 and more in some areas, thanks to a group of elves working overtime in Colorado Springs.
For many people, Christmas is just not complete without a decorated tree inside a warm home. David Fine, who describes himself as the lead elf for the all-volunteer Christmas tree project, has made it his mission to get free trees to families struggling financially. Fine says what began in Colorado Springs in 2010 with $20 and an internet post has grown into a national project.
Our first one-line ad on Craigslist that said free Christmas tree to a family with children struck a chord, which is why we did this. We got 20 responses in an hour. This year, we will have over 2,500 requests for Christmas trees across the country.
Fine says he's come to realize that trees symbolize different things to different people during the holidays, including generosity, caring, love, and hope. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Dr. Gleb Chepersky. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be partly rainy with a low of just below freezing. Tomorrow's weather will have a high of around 40 degrees and more rain. East of the Cascades and Hood River, it'll be partly cloudy with a low of around 35 degrees, followed by some showers tomorrow. Today in history, Emma Goldman the anarchist was exiled to Russia in the year 1919. Her initial support of Russia's October Revolution changed after she witnessed the crushing of the Kronstadt Rebellion. She lived the rest of her years in Canada, Great Britain, and France, and she died in Toronto in the year 1940. The quote of the day is from Emma Goldman. Someone said that it requires less mental effort to condemn than to think. The widespread mental indolence so prevalent in society proves this to only be too true. Rather than go to the bottom of any given idea to examine into its origin and meaning, most people will either condemn it altogether or rely on some superficial or prejudicial definition of non-essentials.
Bronze Star, the newly created Florida company with an unproven track record, never delivered urgently needed supplies to Puerto Rico, which even months later remained in demand on the island. After Hurricane Maria damaged tens of thousands of homes on the island, Bronze Star won more than the $30 million in contracts from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to provide plastic sheeting for various repairs. According to an exclusive Associated Press report, FEMA eventually ended the contracts without paying any money and restarted the process this month to supply more tarps to the island. The earlier effort took nearly 4 weeks from the day FEMA gave the contracts to Bronze Star and the day it canceled them. Thousands of Puerto Ricans are still homeless, and many feel the federal government is taking too long to install tarps. The U.S. has been hit by several severe rainstorms in recent weeks that have created flooding. On December 5th, the United States Senator Elizabeth Warren led a group of senators in calling for an investigation of FEMA's decision regarding its initial contract with Bronze Star. The Department of Homeland Security internal watchdog is now investigating how the inexperienced company won the $30 million contract. Acting Inspector General John Kelly said in a letter addressed to Warren on Wednesday that he would review FEMA's awards to Bronze Star LLC.
And now we hear about Today in Labor History with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. That was the day that Red Scare deportations began. 249 radicals, including anarcho-feminist Emma Goldman, were packed onto the USS Buford and deported to Russia. The year of 1919 had seen massive social convulsions. The Seattle General Strike had kicked off the year. It was followed by coal strikes and steel strikes, bombings and race riots. There were increasing fears of communist ideas and influences in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution. These events touched off a draconian response by the U.S. federal government. Together with the young J. Edgar Hoover, Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer conducted mass raids and arrests of more than 1,000 suspected working-class radicals. The Department of Labor agreed that proclaimed membership in the Union of Russian Workers was a deportable offense. The ship set sail and docked in Finland, where trains transported the deportees into the Soviet Union. The vast majority of those deported had no criminal records and had never participated in any acts of terrorism. They were expelled for speaking out about their political opinions. According to Regan Schmidt, author of Red Scare, FBI and the Origins of Anti-Communism in the United States, employers' associations fueled the anti-radical climate. They were engaged in an intense open-shop counterattack against post-war organizing campaigns and strike activity. The main goal was to discredit unions as subversive, Bolshevistic, and alien to basic American values. Donning the name The American Plan, closed shops were referred to as Sovietism in disguise, and propaganda campaigns were waged to ensure blacklists, internal union dissension, yellow dog contracts, and strike breaking.
Memphis crews worked overnight to remove two Confederate statues from their parks. The move comes after city officials sold the parks for the price of $1,000 to a group called Memphis Green Space. The city of Memphis is being accused of doing this backhanded by groups that are pro-Confederacy. However, they argue that the move was completely legal and unanimously accepted by the city council. Mayor Jim Strickland said, quote, "The forest statue was placed in 1904 as Jim Crow segregation laws were enacted. The Davis statue was placed in 1964 as the civil rights movement changed our country. The statues no longer represent who we are as a modern, diverse city with momentum. As I told the Tennessee Historical Commission in October, our community wants to reserve places of reverence for those we honor," end quote. Other cities, such as New Orleans, have previously taken down Confederate statues in the middle of the night and to avoid violent clashes, such as the one that occurred in Charlottesville and led to the death of Heather Heyer. Mayor Strickland also stated that, quote, "I was committed to remove the statues in a lawful way. From the beginning, we have followed state law, and tonight's action is no different," end quote. The nonprofit group has no plans to sell the parks back to the city.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Trump and Republican lawmakers celebrated the passage of the tax reform bill Wednesday in Washington. The bill includes a measure to open up a section of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to energy development.
They can celebrate very shortly.
Bernadette Dementev reacted to the news, saying the Gwich'in Nation will not back down from efforts to protect Anwar from oil and gas drilling. Dementev is with the Gwich'in Steering Committee. She says it's the calving grounds for caribou, which is central to her people's diet and culture.
Gwich'in Nation used to migrate with the porcupine caribou herd for over 40,000 years, and we would always fall short from entering the coastal plain because that place is sacred to us.
We don't even go there still to this day. And they want to drill for oil in such a sensitive area.
Alaska's congressional delegation joined the president in celebrating the passage of the bill and the Anwar measure, saying it will lead to jobs and economic prosperity. Dementev says the fight is not over as they look into legal options. A Washington tribe and Canadian First Nations are continuing efforts to protect the Northwest from oil and gas transport, pointing to environmental concerns, as Eric Tegedoff reports.
This year, tribes have been at the forefront of opposition against expanding oil and gas transport in the Northwest. They say the latest threat to the environment and their way of life is the Trans Mountain Pipeline through British Columbia. And Houston-based Kinder Morgan got approval from the Canadian government last week to expand it. That would mean Trans Mountain would transport more oil than either the Dakota Access or Keystone XL pipelines and could increase tanker traffic by 7 times in the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Jewel James is with the Sovereignty and Treaty Protection Office for the Lummi Nation.
It's in the form of coal. It's in the form of tar sands oil from the Alberta tar sands. It's Vulcan oil. It's natural gas. All of it is focusing on the Pacific Northwest as the shortest route out of the country.
Extraction projects from the Alberta tar sands to the Bakken Formation in North Dakota use the Northwest as a passageway to Asian markets. James says the Lummi Nation and First Nations in Canada are now considering their next moves to stop expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Native tribes have been on the front lines against the BC pipeline as well as other oil and gas projects that could potentially harm the environment. Yet James feels Native opposition doesn't carry the weight it should in these discussions or in other projects that threaten Indigenous land. He says that's been the case for a long time for tribes in the Northwest.
It's the same old story. It's been happening for 200 years for Native Americans. We're still here. We'll continue our battle to exist. We'll continue to assert our rights as nations and as a people.
James says Native American tribes in the United States and the First Nations in Canada aren't alone in their concern for the environment.
Our people need to be able to voice their concern for the quality of life here in the Pacific Northwest. And we need our voices heard, but we also need the voices of everybody else around us. People around us have to stand up and protect the environment their children live in.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe's documentary called The Water Protectors was released online Thursday. The film tells the story of the tribe as a leader in the battle to protect the environment. It includes footage in North Dakota at Standing Rock of the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Cheyenne River Sioux Chairman Harold Frazier says the government has failed them, but the American people have not. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is continuing to fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline with a lawsuit in court. The tribe says the Dakota Access Pipeline is not its only battle. The Keystone XL project is proposed to cross 3 miles from its reservation. The tribe says both threaten water and tribal way of life. The tribe hopes the film will draw attention to its fight against big oil. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The United Nations General Assembly voted 128-9 on a non-binding resolution urging member states to avoid moving their embassies to Jerusalem. Though the United States was not officially named in the resolution, many in the international community see this as a sharp rebuke of the Trump administration's decision to officially recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That announcement sparked protests throughout the Palestinian territories and resulted in the deaths of at least 4 Palestinian men after Israeli Defense Forces began firing live rounds at protesters last week. 128 member countries voted for the resolution despite threats from the Trump administration earlier this month to discontinue aid to anyone who voted against him. UN Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley doubled down on Trump's threats, announcing ahead of today's vote that she would, quote, be taking names, end quote, of those who voted in favor of the resolution. A similar resolution before the UN Security Council was vetoed by the U.S. on Monday. As a permanent member of the Council, the U.S. has the power to veto any resolution before the 15-member body. Haley's vote on Monday was the first time the U.S. has invoked that power in more than 6 years. Meanwhile, the other 14 members voted in favor of the resolution. Palestinian leaders have hailed today's vote as an affirmation of the international rule of law. Saeb Er Ikot, the Palestinian chief negotiator, was quoted by Al Jazeera as saying, quote, "It's a day of shame to those who stood shoulder to shoulder with the occupation and settlements against international law," end quote. But we appreciate very much that the majority of the international community decided, in spite of the threats and intimidation of the U.S., to stand tall with wisdom, farsightedness, international law, and the rule of law, and not the rule of the jungle. Among the U.S. allies with the courage to openly support the resolution were the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Japan, and South Korea. Canada, Australia, and Mexico were among the 35 countries that abstained from the vote. Joining the U.S. and Israel in voting against the resolution were Guatemala, Honduras, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau, and Togo.
Catalans were at the polls today to elect a new regional government following the ouster of President Carlos Puigdemont and his pro-independence regional government. Reports indicate a quiet and orderly day at polling stations across the country, in contrast to the chaos and police brutality that occurred in October when Mariano Rajoy, the Prime Minister of Spain's national government, ordered polling stations closed across Catalonia. The move was an effort to prevent Catalonia from declaring independence, and today's vote is seen as a de facto referendum on the issue, with voters choosing between leftist pro-independence candidates and Labor Ciudadanos, who favor unification. Catalans showed up in a record numbers with voter turnout of more than 85%. As of this broadcast, with 85% of the votes counted, the pro-independence bloc is expected to gain an absolute majority, winning 70 of the parliament's 135 seats. Official results will be declared on January 5th, at which point the newly formed parliament will have 20 days to elect a speaker and another 10 days to elect a new regional president. It is unclear who will fill those positions. Former President Puigdemont fled Spanish authorities in October and is currently living in exile in Belgium. His number two, Oriol L. Junqueras, chose to stay in country and is currently in jail pending an investigation into the October 27th Declaration of Independence.
According to the Red Cross, the war-ravaged country of Yemen is experiencing the most dire cholera epidemic the world has seen in a decade. In March of 2015, Yemen entered into a brutal civil war that has affected consistent access to food, water, medicine, and fuel. The International Committee of the Red Cross announced last Thursday that more than 1 million people inside the Arabian Peninsula are now affected by cholera. Last month, the World Health Organization issued a warning that said over 2,000 people have already died from the waterborne disease. The problem has worsened with increasingly poor hygiene and sanitation conditions in the country. The Red Cross also said that cholera is not only the challenge attacking the country's population, adding that 80% of Yemenis continue to lack access to the basic clean water, food, and health care. Although the number of cholera cases registered each week has declined over the last 3 months, World Health Organization spokesman Tarek Yarasevic said, "The epidemic is not yet over, and more concerted efforts should be deployed to concern over our insurance of its control in the immediate term and prevention of future outbreaks."
Snake fungal disease is increasingly affecting populations of wild snakes in the eastern and midwestern United States, warns the National Wildlife Health Center. The fungus Ophidiomyces ophioidicola is associated with a decline of 50% of a New Hampshire population of timber rattlesnakes from 2006 to 2007. The disease appears to now be spreading to different species of snakes across a larger geographical area of the U.S. Snakes affected by the fungus end up with scabs, skin abrasions, sores, ulcers, and other skin conditions. Snakes can recover from snake fungal disease, however, it can also be fatal. Fungal diseases happen, but what is causing the snake fungal disease to spread so widely and quickly among snake populations is unclear and scientists continue to monitor cases everywhere. However, the naturally elusive and solitary nature of snakes make assessment harder. Snake fungal disease is spreading at an alarming rate, and to compare the recent decline in bat and amphibian populations worldwide, also caused by fungus, made more resistant because of global climate changes. The consequences of snake fungal disease could be catastrophic on the U.S., and its impact would spread to larger populations of animals interdependent with wild snakes.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Grace Ann Smith. Jasmine Moneymaker is the producer, and Jasmine, our engineer, is Ben Sherigy. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to the KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Positively Revolting. Ani and Lynn take your calls. At 9, One Land, Many Voices, exploring the social, political, and cultural issues of Palestine and Israel. At 10, Valley Views continues the discussion on the concept of maximum income. How much is enough? At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Pacific Underground, a show for and by Asian and Pacific Islander communities in the Northwest. KBOO is your independent source for news and entertainment. Become a member. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Don't cry about it.
It's our organization of the...
Dr. Gleb Chepersky is an activist for truth and a disaster avoidance expert. He is the president and co-founder at International Insights, a nonprofit advocating rational thinking and wise decision-making. He is also the founder of the Pro-Truth Pledge, an initiative to fight fake news and misinformation in public discourse, and is the author of the Amazon bestseller, The Truth Seeker's Handbook, a science-based guide. He's written for Time, Scientific American, Psychology Today, Newsweek, The Conversation, and more. Today, we have him in the studio to talk about the CDC's possible censoring of 7 keywords and its finding meaning. Welcome, Gleb Chepersky. Hello? One moment, we're having a technical difficulty. Hello, Gleb?
It looks like Gleb is lost in ether space for a moment here, and our engineer is checking on how to bring him into the conversation. He's got quite an introduction, being an activist for truth and a disaster avoidance expert, so we're looking forward to talking with him, especially about this crazy issue of censorship of language in the government. That certainly sounds Orwellian. The prohibition on the use of certain words by the Center for Disease Control. So we hope to have him coming online any moment here. Sorry, folks, it's just a brief delay. I see our engineer is working assiduously to get Gleb Chepersky online, get him into this conversation. Sometimes these things happen. Happened to me earlier today. I was interviewing someone for an interview that's going to be broadcast tomorrow on net neutrality, which I thought was a done deal, and apparently it's not. So you'll hear that interview tomorrow evening on the evening news with a writer who says that there's quite a discussion yet to occur on net neutrality that might involve litigation and efforts by state attorneys general to get additional momentum. There's even some Republican members of Congress who seem to be backing the idea that we need to have net neutrality in spite of the ruling by the Federal Communications Commission on December 14th against it. So, we have apparently lost the connection and we're still trying to regain it. And let's see. I see our engineer is trying to redial and get that back. And we're going to go to some music here, I guess, for a moment while we get that connection. Okay, folks, we're back online, and I hope we have Gleb Chepersky. Do we have you on board here, Doctor?
Yes.
Well,
excellent.
Welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Welcome to Cable. I don't know how we got cut off. We've got about 8 minutes, and let's get right to it. We understand you're a truth and disaster avoidance expert, and you're going to be speaking about the censorship in the Center for Disease Control. Is that right?
That's right. So the Trump administration apparently has banned the top U.S. public health agency, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, from using seven words or phrases in its budget documentation. Words like vulnerable, entitlement, diversity, transgender, fetus, evidence-based, and science-based. And I wrote an article about this for Scientific American, which is currently the most popular article there, about how this will lead to people dying.
Can
it
we,
is a very dangerous move.
Is your article in Scientific American, is that available online?
Yes, scientificamerican.com. So if people go there,
cool,
look at the most popular article, they will see that that's the most popular article there.
I'd like to read that. So what's going on? Are we already in the Orwellian environment here where we can't use certain words?
We indeed are. If those words can't be used in the official budget documentation, then those problems will not be acknowledged around issues, things like diversity, vulnerable people, transgender, fetus. And let's not even talk about evidence-based and science-based. I mean, if you can't use evidence-based and science-based practices, what are you going to use? Homeopathy?
What's wrong? Alternative medicine? What's wrong with the term evidence-based, for example?
I don't know what the Trump administration finds problematic about evidence-based, except that Trump himself doesn't advocate for evidence-based medicine. For example, he has often stated that vaccines cause autism. That is a frequent claim that he has made. And we know from extensive scientific research that there is no correlation between vaccines and autism, which is science speak for vaccines do not cause autism. So that is what the research shows. So if the CDC uses actual evidence-based, science-based practices, then it should talk about how vaccines don't cause autism, but that will be a problem for the president who makes this claim. So that is a very convenient way for him to, quote-unquote, not be wrong.
I can see where the...
He doesn't use his face.
I can see why the president might not use this term, since he doesn't seem to practice evidence-based thinking in a lot of what he does. What does this do for us as a society? What are we doing? What effect is this having on us?
Well, from the CDC itself, it's having the effect of more babies and children dying and other vulnerable populations. So if we can't use the phrase evidence-based and science-based in its in the formulations of its official budget documents, well, what is going to happen? Then programs like vaccination are going to be cut because they are evidence-based and science-based, but they don't follow Donald Trump's wishes. They don't follow the administration's wishes. And then, as a result, if there are less vaccination programs, we will have many more measles outbreaks and various other problems. We're already seeing them. This year was the biggest year for measles outbreaks in the United States because so many people are deluded into thinking that vaccines cause autism, and then they don't get their kids vaccinated. Now, if we don't have money for vaccination programs, there will be so many more problems like this, and so many more people will die. It's very dangerous for the health of our society.
And Dr. Chepersky, there's been a lot of confusion around possible censorship. The CDC director, Brenda Fitzgerald, has said no words are actually banned at the CDC, and the CDC was just looking to change the language in its budget report. Is that actually the ban in practice, or what do they mean by that and that confusion behind that?
Sure. So Brenda Fitzgerald is a Trump appointee, and she's been quite involved in Republican politics. I'd be cautious about trusting her description of what's going on. We know from the meetings that long-term analysts of the CDC were outraged and really upset by the directions that they were given. They were told that you shouldn't use words like evidence-based and science-based, and you should use words like follows community in consultation with community wishes and in based on science. That is not a word, that is not a formulation that is given to advocate for vaccination programs if many people in the community are going to go against vaccines. So we know that in the official budget documentations, those words are actually not supposed to be used. In fact, the CDC got back some documents where it used words like entitlement and diversity and fetus and so on, and it was asked to change those words. So while the agency itself in its public commentary may use those terms, apparently it can't use them in the budget documentation. And of course, the budget documentation needs to follow the money. The budget is where the decisions are made. That's where the funding is going to go. And thus, that's where the actions are going to take place.
Doctor, is the idea here that the change in the language will change the reality of the situation? Are we supposed to think that there won't be transgender people if we stop using the word, or what?
It's actually more dangerous than that. So transgender people, of course, will exist, but they won't be visible in our public health documents. And from the government's perspective, what isn't visible and what isn't funded doesn't exist. So transgender people will be there, but they will be experiencing many more health problems because the CDC is not addressing the needs of this population. Just like fetuses, women, pregnant women will be experiencing many more health problems, and their needs won't be addressed because the word fetus is not used. And so what we will see is that more people will be dying, more people will be getting sick, and they won't be getting treated, and we won't know it because the government will not be looking at these issues. So it's the famous phrase, what is visible is what gets managed.
Excuse me, Doctor, we are running short on time here. We really appreciate your participation. It's a troubling sign that the government is trying to alter our language like this.
And I sure do wish we had some more time to talk.
Thank you for joining us, Doctor.
Yeah, sorry about the technical difficulties earlier.
No worries. Well, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Gleb Chepersky. You can find his article on scientificamerican.com.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.